Okay. Let's get back to business here. Joan Bird and her book, Montana UFOs and Extraterrestrials. All right, can we develop that a little bit more? You said there were some wonderful things that also came about.
With Udo Wartna.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things, he stressed his impression that they were men just like us and very nice chaps. I think that was the wording that he used maybe in the letter to John Glenn.
Nice. Did Stan still have his letter, his original letter, Stan Friedman?
Yes.
Good.
In fact, I have I think actually what I have in the book is a photocopy of the cover page.
Nice. Very good.
That was sent to Stan, yeah. Yeah. So one of his daughters, he did actually tell the story to. He had been shut up because he kind of took a young fellow under his wing who was the son of a friend of his who had died. And this young guy, he took him to the site and told him about what had happened there. And then the young guy came back and ridiculed him to a lot of his friends and people that he knew. And he just shut up about it. He stopped talking about it. And he didn't even tell his children or his wife until fairly late in his life.
Wow.
The primary person that he confided in was that he was Mormon. And one of the people that he talked to was there's in each one of the Mormon precincts or areas of, I forget what they call them, they have somebody who's kind of an elder that is like a spiritual counselor, and that was who he talked to about it. Yeah, stake patriarch, that's what you call him. LDS,
okay.
Patriarch.
What about this young guy here that Udo took under his wing and tried to help? Did somebody get to him?
I just think it was, it's kind of a teenage thing to do. You look to ridicule people, or
right.
I don't know what was going on. But anyway, his daughter said that, they were driving from Provo to Ogden sometime when she was in her 40s, and I think he was probably in his 70s or 80s, and he decided that he had a story he wanted to tell her, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that after he told her this totally fantastic story, that she looked at him and said, Dad, you have never lied to me, so I have to believe you. And she told me that she had been in charge of the Just Say No programs that developed in the Provo schools with the high schools, Just Say No to Drugs and Alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes those teenagers their attentions would wander, and she could see that they were not paying attention to what the program was or what she was saying to them. And she would often at that time tell them that she had a story to tell them, and then she would tell the story about her father and use it as an object lesson so that if they had developed some level of trust with their parents by always telling the truth, then if something happened that was hard for their parents to believe, they would believe them because they'd always told the truth, because that was what she said to her dad after telling her this amazing story about mm-hmm. his encounter. So there were all these high school students that got this story about Udo Wartna.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Anything else about his time on board that you remember or that was explained or discussed that she might have talked to you about that her dad
told
her?
Well, this is one of the things he said, and I love this quote. He told her, and I think this was the only person he told, that he felt remarkable love or comfort in their presence and did not want to leave them.
Mm-hmm.
That there was, somehow an atmosphere there that was,
It's called kindness.
Yeah. And how do I just hear these guys, and the other one, Leo Dvorak, said similar kinds of things, these kind of, hard and tough guys trying to describe something that's very subjective, but which made a strong impression on them. And his daughter said that he just loved to dig, and he would go back as often as he could. He moved to the Portland area, and that was where he raised his family. He would come back almost every summer, and she said it was because he loved to dig. But his best friend said he always hoped that he would have another encounter.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But he never did. Yeah.
100-foot-wide ship is a pretty big piece of machinery, and I wonder if it had been anyone other than Udo, If they had would have been up to this, they might have run. Who knows what they would have done? But here you have an intellectual young man who's able in 1940 to deal with this. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said they looked very human,
right?
And that their English was excellent. And the guy looked like he was about 35 years old. I think that he found out later he was actually 600 years, Earth years old,
mm-hmm.
but looked like a young guy. And then there was another fellow on board that looked older. I think he might have been white-haired, and he was 900 years old, mm-hmm. according to you. So, you know.
Well, you never know.
But his credibility was so good. He was just a very honest, ethical man. That's what everybody that knew him said about him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that the quality of the witnesses is always so important. And it is subjective, but I think that it's such an important factor in deciding whether or not people are telling the truth. People often ask me, how do you know if they're telling the truth? And it has a lot to do with their character. And you ask questions about their character, and I think that that's a pretty good indication.
You bet. All right. Just looking at man with a baseball, the picture. That's funny. He's in the stadium. This was a farm team for the Brooklyn Dodgers. This is a big deal. Now this is in Great Falls.
Right.
They must have sold that thing out every time back then.
Well,
I'll bet they did.
I don't know. Maybe they did. You know, he was a very interesting character, and he was quite an athlete himself. He grew up mm-hmm. in Miles City, and he was on the basketball team, and he was only 5'6". Mm. But that basketball team won state championship in their league, and he was a starter. So, mm-hmm. and then he was mm-hmm. also a baseball player, but it wasn't baseball at the high school, but he played in a junior league. And his daughter told me that the Brooklyn Dodgers offered him a contract graduating from high school. And I don't know if it was at their farm team or, you know, I'm not sure.
Oh, they would have started him out at the farm level, yeah, and built
yeah.
him. That's a remarkable yeah. compliment. He must have been something else.
He was written up as a pitcher. He was a very good pitcher.
At 5'6"?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the family was very athletic. His father was an Italian immigrant. And,
those
guys worked hard. His brother was also very athletic. But he wanted to be a journalist. He had been a newspaper delivery boy, and he just really believed in the importance of journalism. It was something that he was passionate about, and rather than go into sports, much as he liked it, he wanted to get a degree in journalism for the University of Montana Journalism School, so that was what he did.
Nick had it figured out.
Yeah, then he went on, and he did this program that was it was a radio program called Nick's Picks. And he had actually gotten a hold of some kind of a mathematical formula for predicting the outcome of the college and high school basketball, baseball, and football games, which are very important in rural Montana. This is really, this is important stuff. And he used to predict them, and he was like, I don't know, his son said he was like 85% accurate. And his son also confided in me that it was his wife that actually did the computations. Kind of like hidden figures in the NASA, mm-hmm. but the women mm-hmm. that were doing, but he was the showman and the publicist and, you know, the extrovert, and he would do this radio show, and later it got to be a television show as
Behind every successful man is a woman, right? Isn't that the old saying?
Yeah, and she was the mathematician. I just love that.
That's funny.
It is funny.
That's good. You got to meet some really wonderful people. Good. Very good.
Yeah,
nice to hear
this. Yeah, that was a lot of fun getting to interview. I didn't get to meet him, but I got to talk to his daughter, and I got to meet his son, and
Well, it sounds like from your personality, you got along very well with them, and I'm sure they shared a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We have another picture. This is a gentleman in a World War II naval uniform, Leo Dvorak. What do we got?
Well, Leo, his contact experience first happened in 1932 when he was 12 years old. And actually, I had to cheat a little bit on that one. That was over the border in North Dakota, about 50 miles near a town called Killdeer. But I felt like I could include him because he continued to have encounters. He had encounters for most of his life, although the last encounter where he was actually able to go on board the ship was in, I think it was 1962, and it was near Bozeman. So I felt like I could count him as a
That's 30 years after the first.
Right.
So how many different encounters did he have over the years, do you know?
Well, he's written this book called UFOs Are With Us, Take My Word.
Uh-huh.
And it's a delightful little book. He wrote it for young audiences, and it starts out as this great adventure story about he was 12 and his little brother was 8.
Uh-huh.
And the two of them, this was during the Dust Bowl days in the 30s, you know, the dirty 30s, and it was a hard time and a very hot time. And his father was a custom combiner and was gone a lot, but it was a good-sized family. I think that there were 4 or 5 children, and so they were, you know, having trouble like everybody, making ends meet, and they would go finish their chores, and then they'd take off in the summertime and go out looking for rabbits and goofing off, like mm-hmm. a couple of boys would.
Mm-hmm.
And they were wandering around about a mile from their farm and came over a hill and looked down in this little hollow and saw this about 100-foot-wide round machine was what they thought it was,
mm-hmm.
because that was the only thing they could imagine
sure.
that it was.
Sure.
And they knew about combines, and it was a lot bigger than a combine, but still, that's there it was, sitting out there. And they thought that was pretty curious, and they started going towards it, and they ran into an invisible wall. And then they couldn't go any further, and they thought that was pretty weird. So they sat down next to this invisible wall, and they could see that they saw a rabbit run into it, too, that there was this force field that was keeping them from getting any closer to this object. And that
uh-huh.
was very curious. So they sat down and just watched for a while, and they saw people getting off this machine.
Yeah.
And they saw a ladder come down, and people come out. I think they said there were about 6 of them, and they were looking at the ground and seemed to be picking things up or whatever. And they watched them for a while, and then they realized they were late for dinner, and they dashed home as quickly as they could. But they came back the next day because they wanted to, you know, see this curious thing again. And when they
sure.
came back the next day, it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that really puzzled them. But they continued to come back. And at some point in the future, when they came back and were looking at that spot, it flew in. And that was the first that they knew that it was a flying machine. And then they began to try to approach it, and the invisible wall got closer and closer to the spacecraft.
It shrunk?
And
so it let them...
The wall, yeah.
It let them get closer to it.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, it was gone altogether, and they were able to meet some of these beings, some of these people. It looked like people to them, anyway. And he talked about how both he and his little brother, more than anything else, they wanted to go on the ship. And they kept thinking, you know, we want to go on the ship, we want to go on the ship. And what they found was that these beings then would answer them, even though they were afraid to ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
The beings answered them and said, you will eventually be able to go. Or so. Anyway, they became aware that they would answer the questions before they had spoken them.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes when they would have questions, the answers would pop into their heads from they didn't know where. So he describes very well how they became aware that these beings, these visitors, were telepathic.
This is 1930, Joan?
32.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very early account.
Wonderful story. Wonderful.
And a very, very benevolent account. Yeah, and yeah, and then eventually
the name of I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Eventually, they were able to go on board, and it was just so phenomenal. And they describe a lot of the advanced technologies, and they laugh about how his little brother was always trying to outsmart these chairs that would slide under you as you were sitting down. The chairs would move under you. And so the little brother, the 8-year-old, was trying to figure out if he could. He was trying to outfox the chairs by trying. You know, he'd squat somewhere, and the chair would zoom over to where he was. And
wow.
He describes a number of the technologies that they were exposed to, and his mother commented on how they knew all these things about astronomy that she hadn't taught them and didn't know how they'd found these things out. But he also commented on how he felt in their presence. And this was a German family. His parents were immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And in the 30s, you know, the Germans were really persecuted. They were stigmatized.
Right.
And so the kids at school made fun of him and teased him about being a crowd or whatever. And so they didn't really have a lot of friends, and they were very untrusting and didn't really feel accepted. But these visitors were very interested in them, very kind to them. At some point later in his life, Leo told me, and I got to know Leo before he died, he told me that they were the best friends that he ever had. When I first met Leo, he was kind of a prickly guy. He was working on the book, and I had found out that he was working on the book and asked if I could meet with him, and we met at one of his favorite hangouts in Helena here, and he was very suspicious because he had been disbelieved for so long. You know, that's what he, and they told him also, you will not be believed until you are an old man. And he told me he was writing this book, and I said, I'm very interested in it. And he asked me, so why are you interested, and what did you study in school? And I said, psychology. And he said, well, that's pretty useless, you know.
How funny.
He was gruff. But I told him, if you publish this book, I will help you market it. And when the book came out, I knew a reporter at the Helena Paper Independent Record, and they were able to get a wonderful big picture of Leo on the top fold of the front page of the local paper. And Jess Marcel lived in Helena at the time, and we invited him to come along.
Jesse
with Leo.
Lived in Helena?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Okay, that's another tangent we could go down, but let me try to wrap this. So we had 150 people come out to the Methodist Church to hear Leo Dvorak and Jess Marcel. Yeah. And after that, it changed his personality. He was finally affirmed. And Timothy Good came and interviewed him from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
He suddenly was valued for this amazing experience that he'd had, and it totally changed him. And he died about 4 years, I guess, after the book came out. But I visited with him a number of times, and I was over at his trailer one day, and I just asked him, so Leo, you know, you said they were telepathic, and, you know, said in your book you hadn't been on the ship since 62. I said, but do they communicate with you? And he kind of looked around, you know, and then he nodded. And I said, oh, he says, yeah, when they go over, they communicate with me. So knowing that that is one of the diagnostic tests for psychosis, hearing voices, a lot of people are afraid to admit that.
Yeah,
but after
yeah.
he had described learning about telepathy, it was easier to believe.
What a wonderful story. Go ahead, please.
He had a second book that he wanted to come out. You know, the military was always very interested in people that have had contact.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the witnesses that have come out, Clifford Stone is one of them, talk about how they were actively recruited because the military found out that they had had contact.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo told me that he had a lot more that he wished he could say, but he couldn't. I guess it was one of those non-disclosure things.
So he took it with him.
Well, he gave a lot of his notes to a fellow and asked him at the end, as he was dying, to write that book. And I don't know what's that. This man is not well now, and I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But he has a granddaughter that was very interested in his life and of this these events that happened. So possibly it will come out. But he was in the military. He was an interrogator in World War II. So he had a pretty intense life. Might have had something to do with him being a little gruff. But I think that there's a lot more to this story, and I hope that someday it does come out.
You know what you need to do. I'm not going to even say it.
Well, there are so many stories to track down, Jeff. You know, it's really
Oh, I know. When? Right. But this seems like a big one. If he left notes, and the man in custody of the notes now is not up to it or interested, maybe you can get a copy of them. Something. Just tell him they've got to be preserved in case the government comes and takes them, whatever. I think this is very important. UFOs are with us. Take my word. Leo Dworshak.
Yeah, I wanted to read this quote that from his comments about this, again, this benevolence, that they seem to have something about them that other people we had met before didn't have, or perhaps it is the other way around. I am certain that hatred and violence are not a part of their behavior. It does not seem to exist with them.
Wow, sign me up. I'll go there right now. I'm so tired of anger, hate, and violence. It's just disgusting. We're failing here on this planet. We're going backwards. We're not going forwards.
Well, I think
we're being forced. We're being forced. It's not our choice.
I meet a lot of people that are that really do value kindness and understand how very important that is.
Oh yes. But do you see it in the media? Do you hear about it?
No, but that's not. That's media's thing. They don't. I think there's way much more going on than we'll ever see in the media. Because I think the media is all about spreading fear. I think that's.
Oh yes, it's all about anxiety, anguish, stress. You name it. UFOs are with us. Take my word. By Leo Dworshak. You can get it on Amazon. Get yourself a copy. And I really do hope that somehow you can make time to track this down or get with the granddaughter and get her to understand that this has got to be photocopied and put away somehow safely. Send me a copy. I'll take care of it. I'm not going anywhere. This is very important.
There's just so much. There's so much going on right now. And I'm very interested in what the contactees are talking about now. And so that's where a lot of my interest is going, is reading the contactees. But you're right. He was also a contactee. And if he was continuing to have contact or be working for the military, it is important.
How many times was he on board? Do you remember, Joan? Did he tell you?
Let's see. No more
several?
Than half a dozen at the most.
Oh, half a dozen? That's a ton.
Maybe half a dozen. I think that last one, there hadn't been one for a long time in Bozeman. There was one around Sydney, Montana. I'm not sure how many times he and his brother went on board, but it was more than once.
Did they take him for a ride ever?
No, they never flew with him as far as I know. Yeah.
Wow. Wow, wow. I can see why Timothy came all the way over from the UK.
He really liked Leo's story.
And
he wrote about it in one of his more recent books.
Wow. All right, hold on, if you would, please, and we have a half an hour to go, so you have so much to talk about. You pick where you'd like to go. Malmstrom is a big story. It's we can do that. Whatever you'd like.
Okay.
All right, we'll be right back with Joan in a minute. Okay, and welcome back. Just amazing material we get to hear, thanks to Joan. Do look at her book. Just click on her name under guests, and you'll be able to see it right there. And we're looking at photos. We've seen three photos of three rather remarkable people. And so what do we want to do this last section?
Well, what I would like to do is talk a little bit about the nuclear missile shutdowns, because it is that was really the case that made me first think about writing a book. But then I'd like to take a little bit of time to go over the other two graphs that I put up on the website, too, about encounters with ETs.
Mm-hmm.
you know, Robert Hastings is really the guy that has done the most research,
yes,
on the whole UFOs and nukes business, and he has a documentary that's 45 minutes long that's fabulous. It's really kind of a summary of his research, and it is outstanding. And I defer to him for all his wonderful work. And then Robert Salas is a personal hero of mine because he was the first guy that really talked about this, and he is the one that has interpreted this as being a warning to us, that this was something, not a threat, but just a warning that, you know, these nuclear weapons are not a good idea.
Right. I've had Robert on the program about 2-3 times, I guess, years and years ago. Very brave, forthright. Really admired him, yeah.
Yes. He said to me, I don't know if he might have said this on your show or not, but one of the things that really struck me was that after the guards had told him that this object was hovering, and the guard hung up the phone because he said somebody was injured, because one of the other guards hurt himself on the barbed wire or something, he heard in his mind this voice that said, "We're going to shut you down." Do you remember him saying that?
I don't. I can't at this point, no. It's been too many years.
Yeah, I just thought that was quite
remarkable. That is very interesting. For those of you who don't know, give them a 30-second synopsis. UFOs over an ICBM base. I forget how many of the silos were shut down. The launch crews deep underground lost complete control of everything. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah, and actually the case that Robert Salas told us about was at Oscar Flight, and the week before this had happened at Echo Flight. Mm. But he was the first guy that talked about it. March 24th, 1967. Last year was the 50th anniversary, and Bob did a wonderful recount of what that was like when it happened last year about the time. Mm-hmm. And actually, the Great Falls Tribune published a long article about it, too, last year. Mm. Yeah, there's a guy there that is working on it. So what he said was that he got a call from the guard that the guard was watching this object in the sky that was behaving strangely and was not behaving like an aircraft. And it was odd that he got the call, because usually the communication between the guards on the surface and the guys down in the base of underground in the launch control facility was very professional and limited in discussion. But this guard had just called him and said, "Okay, we're watching this zigzag flight, and we don't know what it is." And he had kind of laughingly said, "Like a UFO?" And the guy just said, "Well, I just don't know if any of our aircraft can do this." And then a few minutes later, the guard calls again, and at this point he's screaming, and he says, "Sir, you know, we have this glowing object which is hovering over the launch control facility. What do we do?" And shortly after that, he said, "I've got to go. Somebody's been injured." And right after, Salas said, "Well, describe it. Tell me about it." And he said, it's red-orange, and it's kind of throbbing, glowing. And then the guard cut off the phone conversation. And while he was waiting for him to call back, he said he heard this distinctly in his head, "We're going to shut you down." And then he watched all 10 of the monitoring devices go no-go. And each one of the flights oversaw 10 different missiles control systems. So, yeah, he watched them all go down. But I just thought that was so interesting that he heard this message.
Fascinating. There was a story out of the Soviet Union when it fell. A lot of stories came out. You know this one. They had the same thing. And apparently, the UFO over their missile base took command of one or more of the ICBMs, fully loaded, ready to go, and began the countdown.
And they could launch mode.
They couldn't stop it. Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And Hastings has a witness that said the same thing happened in Minot, the Minot Air Force Base.
North Dakota, yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I remember hearing about that too. So.
Yeah.
Are we gonna wake up in time? That's the big question, Joan. I don't know. We're getting warnings. We're being told, "Knock it off," and it's just really frustrating to me.
Anyway. Yeah. Do you know about the Amicizia case in Italy, the friendship case in Italy? It's a very interesting case. I don't know if you've ever had anybody on the program talk about that. There aren't that many people.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think
Paula Harris is the one that probably knows the most about it because of her Italian connections.
Uh-huh.
And there's an Australian researcher, Warren Aston, who has written a book about it. But the primary book that came out was translated into English by Stefano Breccia. That was called the Friendship Case in Italy, Il Costo Amicizia. And in the movie that was made about that case, it's an amazing case. It's a mass contact case. And I think that Breccia says that there were probably 200 people that had contact with a group of visitors who were in an underwater base off the coast of Italy in the Adriatic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that this began in 1956 and went until 1974. It was a very long-lasting case. And there was an awful lot of connection that they took some of the Italians down to the space. Anyway, a lot of amazing things happened. But in the movie, one of the things it said was that they told the Italians that they had gone to these nuclear missile
launch facilities, yeah.
Launch facilities, and shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
They claimed responsibility for having done this to try to get the message across that we needed to abandon nuclear weapons. And I just thought that was interesting because they said that their mission was to try to establish essentially kind of an embassy, kind of an intergalactic intergalactic embassy with representatives from a number of different civilizations. And in the end, their conclusion was that we just weren't ready.
Well, there you go. I'm afraid we're not.
Well, that was in 74. I think there is so much contact going on now that...
It's not making its way into the mass consciousness because the media won't allow it. It's shut down.
I know, but there's a lot of other medias out there, and you are a prime example. There are so many sources of information these days that it's very hard to control what people get to learn
about. I'm always looking for people like you, and I want to thank Frank Chile again for putting a wonderful person on the program, and you really to be commended for your work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
There were a couple of other little tidbits here that I just want to throw into this whole mountain.
Yeah, then we'll jump on your psychological and life changes when we get to that.
All right. So one of the things that we have noticed, some of the people that I know actually here in Helena who grew up in Great Falls have know that they have been abducted, know that they've had these experiences. In fact, I've also got a mass missing time case, and they all think that they have been pretty negative experiences. In fact, they pretty much all have PTSD. They can't remember very much about it, but it makes me wonder if there might not have been some things going on with the military at Malmstrom that were, you know, sometimes my labs or something like that might have been happening there. And I don't know, but there are an awful lot of people in Great Falls that were abductees and do not have very good thoughts about, you know, what they can't remember much, but they just feel like it was not good, whatever it was.
Well, that raises the obvious question. Who was doing the abducting?
Yeah.
And so...
Right.
Go ahead.
Here's another little tidbit I just want to throw out. I was recently contacted by a woman who grew up right next to the Air Force base. And when she was 6 years old, she was playing in the afternoon with her brother, who was, she said he was two, waiting for their father to come home, who worked on the railroad, and they were out running around out in the summertime. And she saw this, what looked like a balloon, and she said it looked like a football. It was football-shaped, and it was about 2 feet long, maybe about 14 inches or diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And she was chasing it, went trying to catch it, and she thought that when it hit the barbed wire fence, it was going to pop. But to her surprise, as it approached the barbed wire fence, it went up and over the top of the fence, and then came back down to the same level it had been flying out and continued flying at that same level.
Mm-hmm.
So now she was really intrigued, and she, you know, ran faster. And as she would pull away, and then it would slow down, and then she'd catch up closer to it, and then it would take off again and then slow down, like it was kind of luring her. And at some point, she caught up with it. And when she caught up with it, she had thought it was like a solid color or object, but when she caught up with it, it had a window in it, and there was a being with its arm sticking out the window looking back at her, and she described a classic gray with the almond-shaped eyes and the pointed chin and the no nostrils looking at her, very tiny in this two-foot-long football-shaped thing. She said that it felt like it was looking right through her. And I asked her, how close were you to it? And she said, 6 inches away.
So what a story.
Yes, but this thing about the size thing, don't know what's going on there. I mean, I've heard other stories about people, you know, getting into some balls of light that suddenly became, or small ships that became big ships. This whole dimensional thing is so curious, and it breaks all of our laws of anything that we know about physical reality.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of anything like that, of this size dimension thing? Is that something that you've run across?
Yes. A number of stories over the years. A lot of them, actually. Not only that, but when people go into a craft, they're in there for an hour, and then a couple of days have passed. There's a time issue as well.
Yeah.
And then the craft is very small when it comes through the atmosphere, and when it comes down to ground level, it apparently becomes quite a bit larger.
How do they do that? It calls to mind, you know, the Men in Black, and where they open up the locker in the airport, and there's a city in there.
That's right. The scale. We're hung up on scale. Everything's by our scale, and that's not the way the universe works. It's a whole different thing.
Makes me wonder if you know, maybe that is other dimensions have to do with scale as much as frequency. I don't know.
It could be. I think everything's on the table. I really do.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to take a look at your...
It's
just go down the bottom under Joan Bird, and you'll see psychological and life changes after an ET contact.
You know, the abductions have gotten so much coverage, and a lot of them are very terrifying to the people that experience them. And I think that the benevolent cases have kind of gotten short shrift. Not that I think that they're all benevolent, and I always emphasize this when I give the talk. Mm-hmm. But just the fact of the whole idea of aliens is so frightful to so many people. I sat next to a guy on a plane recently, and he said, you know, I haven't thought about it much. It's just too scary. And it was a very honest approach. And I think a lot of people, I mean, it's a very disturbing subject to get into. And I always tell people to be gentle with themselves. And I say, we're all undergoing ontologic shock. That term that John Mack used to describe what happens to people when they get abducted and their whole, everything they thought they knew about the nature of reality has suddenly been shattered. That all is kind of happening to us as we try to integrate this information that challenges all what we know about physics and all of that. So one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to include these two cases of encounters with very benevolent beings, that the people who encountered them were kind of haunted by that. So I was very interested to see the results of this recent study by Free, and it was Edgar Mitchell that really wanted to see this happen, the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. Are you familiar with that?
Not too much. I've heard of it.
So they sent out a questionnaire to, I think, around 3,500 people. And these were people that had conscious waking encounters, not that they remembered in hypnosis.
Right.
But that they could remember. And the results are just quite amazing. The questionnaire is extensive, and you can find it on their website, experiencer.org. But the ones that I put in here, how did contact change your life? So 12% said it was either highly negative or slightly negative. But 72% it was either highly positive or slightly positive, which is significant.
These people, very significant,
really,
yeah.
Yeah, and then three were neutral. And then when they were asked about the changes, the list of things I just found totally fascinating. How these people were impacted by their changes. And so that's the psychological profile changes strongly increased. My concern with spiritual matters, my desire to help others, my compassion for others, my appreciation of the ordinary things in life, my ability to love others, my tolerance, my insight into the problems of others, concern with the welfare of planet Earth, understanding of what life is all about, concern with ecological matters, and conviction that there is life after death. Those were the things that were increased.
And now, I want to underscore one word, my conviction that there is life after death. All these things are the result of having an interaction in an ET event. This is very interesting. One wonders how much of that would be a reflexive reaction or how much of it was encouraged by the visitors.
Many of them had multiple contact, multiple contact experiences, not just one time. And then decreased was my concern with material things in life, my interest in organized religion, my fear of death, and my desire to become a well-known person.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess I just like to emphasize that we have a lot of potential benefits from interacting with these visitors, from entering that larger community.
Yes, yes.
And so I want to try to allay people's fears about that, even though I do absolutely think there are some visitors out there, one teacher I know calls them the hoodlums, that are into power and domination, you know, and have kind of spread that, and I think that they've probably been on the planet a long time.
I think they also are in bed with and in working relationships with some of the dark human forms on this planet. I think that's part of the problem, too. Their deal's been made, I think.
Yeah, you
have a wonderful angle to pursue that is any normal human being is going to want to hear more about this. What Joan just said, psychological profile changes after an ET event strongly increased my concern with spiritual matters, my desire to help others, my compassion for others, my appreciation of the ordinary things in life, my ability to love others, my tolerance of others, my insight into the problems of others, my concern with the welfare of planet Earth, my understanding of what life is all about, my concern with ecological matters, my conviction that there is life after death, strongly increased after encounters. This is about as positive as it gets. This is good stuff. And I hope
it makes me wish they would contact a few more people.
A lot more. I've always felt that Robert Wise, I don't know what he knew or didn't know, but the day the Earth stood still, the ship lands on the White House lawn.
Yeah.
And we're given the ultimatum. You got 1 month to denuclearize or the planet is going to be toasted. And I think we're to the point now where the powers that be on the planet would I'm hoping that that'll happen, that they'll get an ultimatum. They're not going to listen to us. They think they've got it all locked up. And in many ways, they do. But individually, when you read things like Joan has put up here, and I just went through again, this is very positive, very encouraging.
Yes.
So
we need encouragement.
We really
need it right now. You know, I definitely believe that we have access with our consciousness to creative abilities that we've only begun to tap, only beginning to tap.
I completely agree.
And we are
agree.
Programmed so much to think negatively and to think catastrophe and that.
Well, that whole list I read that you read, if you want a definition of kindness, it's there. That's it. That's all kindness.
Absolutely.
And care.
But it is. It is. And that sense of connection to the rest of the life on this planet, too. Yeah.
Hi, we are so tricked and so deceived and compartmentalized into thinking that we're different than everything else on the planet. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing.
Right.
It's sad. Joan, thank you for being here and sharing so much. That was just terrific. And
well, thank you, Jeff. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And if I can do anything to help, and I'd like to have you back down the road when you're ready, just let me know.
Okay.
Okay? Right. Take good care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night. Good night, everybody.
Joan Bird. All right? There you go. Montana UFO sightings. Very interesting material to think about. We will be back tomorrow night. Take good care, and we'll talk then.